actually, I thought I saw a dot that could have been him, but I'm not sure.
High schoolers from Anchorage witnessed the president's inauguration firsthand, but from far away. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, January 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the state tries to recover its losses on the Matanuska Creamery loans.
The $900,000, that's the amount that's owed to pay all of these loans in full.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, welcoming Clare House residents to their new home. Learn more at cssalaska.org. And by Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com.
President Obama swore in for his second term today. He spoke to a crowd on the National Mall of about a million people, with millions more tuned in at home. And while most people watched from afar, some lucky Alaskans were there to witness it firsthand. APRN's Peter Granitz caught up with students from South Anchorage High School in Washington, D.C.
Today was decidedly more tuned down than the president's first inauguration 4 years ago. The White House estimates there were a million people on the National Mall. That's about 800,000 fewer than in 2009, but it does not mean things went swimmingly.
D.C. gave me its best shot, and we overcame it, you know? So now that we're here, we're like, ah, whoo!
That's South Anchorage High School history teacher Todd Houston. He's in charge of a group of students who are in town to take in the inauguration in person. In his words, there was a miscommunication with security that dictated their spot on the two-mile-long stretch of monuments and museums. And that spot, far closer to the Washington Monument soaring into the sky than the bunting-draped Capitol, was a bit further than senior Dylan Lance anticipated.
It was really different than I was expecting, actually. I don't know, just because, you know, when I always imagined going to the inauguration, I thought, you know, I'd get to shake hands with Obama, and then I realized I'm going to be like 2-3 miles away. I thought I saw a dot that could have been him, but I'm not sure.
Lance plans on studying nursing next year at the University of Alaska, Anchorage, but you could mistake him for a seasoned political analyst. He says he was happy to hear the president talk about climate change.
I said something that he really didn't do too much of last time, and I said now that it's his, you know, he's in his second term, he's got a chance to really work on that, because first of all, he doesn't have to worry about re-election, but it would be, I think, yeah, it's cool that he's visiting that.
Today's speech showed a more forceful tone than the president has illustrated in the past, perhaps showing that he intends to govern independent of a Congress that is not always willing to cooperate. And one issue Mr. Obama did not mince words on was equal rights for gays and lesbians, something that South High freshman Nick Field says is entirely appropriate.
That's important. A few members of my family are gay, and it's, you know, it needs to change.
Teacher Todd Houston says today's firsthand civics lesson is worth countless hours in a classroom. He says it's important for students to hear the president offer an outline for governing for the next 4 years. And he thinks the president's plans were broad enough that they won't offend too many political opponents.
It's good for him to say these things. They're broad strokes. Now, of course, I'm a skeptic because I teach history. I'd like to see what actually legislation is going to come across and happen. So, but you know what? Hey, it's an inaugural address. I mean, you know, at least on one day, bring everyone together.
And as many members of Congress mentioned today, tomorrow is a new day. That's when the real work begins. And that one happy bipartisan day full of pomp and circumstance is already history. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
The Army's second highest-ranking civilian leader visited Fort Wainwright last week to talk about Alaska and the strategic role it plays in the nation's defense, and how that might help protect the state's military installations from cutbacks during upcoming budget battles in Washington, D.C. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Army Undersecretary Joseph Westfall was on his way back from a tour of U.S. military facilities in Asia when he stopped by Fort Wainwright after a day-long visit to Army training facilities around the interior and the Missile Defense Base at Fort Greely. Westfall says he was impressed with what he saw.
You know, when I toured today, for example, the Black Rapids training area, and oversaw all of the large training areas, we have nothing like that Nothing as significant of that in other parts of the Pacific region.
Westfall says the state's vast training ranges and the rapid response striker brigades at Wainwright and Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson make Alaska an essential part of the new U.S. military policy that places much greater emphasis on Asia and the Pacific Rim. He says Alaska's strategic geographical location puts the state literally in the middle of the Asia-centric policy.
We think the elements that are here are important to our strategy, important to our force.
Westfall says Alaska's location will prove even more important in the years ahead because of increased shipping along the already busy route along the Gulf of Alaska and the likelihood of additional routes if, as many predict, the waters to the north open up as the polar ice recedes.
It's not just about wars. It's also about trade and commerce.
Westfall says all those factors should help protect Alaska's military installations from heavy budget cuts that Congress may dictate as lawmakers wrestle with reducing the nation's budget deficit. He says the state's army posts are safe, at least for now, from federal base closure actions.
There's no planning going on to eliminate any of our installations in the state of Alaska.
Westfall says he cannot, however, rule out cuts that may result if Congress fails to pass legislation to reduce the federal budget deficit in March. He says the so-called sequestration of some $500 billion in defense funding over the next 10 years that's called for in the 2011 Budget Control Act would force the Pentagon to cut its budget far more deeply than the $487 billion already scheduled to be cut over the next 10 years. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
When the Matanuska Creamery closed its doors on December 30th, it left more than 15 people without jobs, and it left a debt to the state of about $900,000. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, the creamery's closure marked the end of a dream of establishing a viable dairy industry in the valley.
The creamery's demise did not come as a surprise. The milk, cheese, and ice cream production facility got its beginning as a desperate solution to the plight of Matanuska Valley dairy farmers, who needed a place to sell their milk after the state-run Matanuska-made dairy shut down. At the time, in late 2007, Matanuska Valley dairymen were faced with slaughtering their cows or finding a new market. A local entrepreneur, Kyle Buse, secured a federal grant that, coupled with private investment, provided enough money to open a new dairy business, Valley Dairy, doing business as the Matanuska Creamery. But creamery owners relied, too, on the state's Agricultural Revolving Loan Fund, a program designed to enhance state agricultural production through low-interest loans. But the creamery defaulted on payments, and the state recalled those loans in August of last year. Karen Olson is the former CEO and president of the now-defunct creamery.
They actually pulled notes in early August, and the Attorney General's office and I had worked out a deal where they would get paid all of their money, they would suspend payments for 6 months, and we would move into a new location which promised much lower overhead. And the deal was nixed by the Board of Agriculture right out the gate.
In August, Olson had asked the state's Board of Agriculture and Conservation, or BAC, to forgive the creamery's $50,000 payment on its revolving loan fund debt. But the board refused, and that was essentially the death knell for the creamery.
In late August, they added what turned out to be an unmanageable addition to the deal that we had worked out with the AG's office, which was that the owners put up a certain amount of money, $50,000.
Olson says efforts to raise that amount in in-kind donations failed. So instead, the Board of Agriculture called the entire amount of the loan due and has seized the assets of the creamery. Francie Havermeister, Division of Agriculture Director, has referred questions about the case to Bob McFarlane, an Assistant Attorney General with the state. McFarlane is working to recoup some of the money that the creamery owes.
There are three loans involved. The number I just quoted you, the $900,000, that's the total amount that's owed on a loan. And when the board calls the loan due as a result of a default, the entire amount comes due. That's the amount that's owed to pay all of these loans in full.
He says the state has taken back the creamery's assets, such as pasteurizers, vehicles, trailers, and the like, and will auction them off in February. McFarlane says the state is taking a loss on the creamery loans and that the auction income is likely to make up the bulk of what the state will recover. The creamery owes money to dairy farmers as well, although McFarlane would not say how much. The collapse of the creamery puts at least two Matanuska Valley dairy farmers right back where they were 5 years ago. With no place to sell their milk, their cows may have to be slaughtered. In an action since calling in the state loans, the Board of Agriculture has approved a $500,000 loan for Palmer dairy farmers Gene and Bob Havermeister to put in an on-farm bottling plant on their dairy farm.
The people running that dairy have been in the dairy business for, I believe, 53 years. They absolutely know what they're doing. They also own the property. They didn't have to lease or pay a landlord or pay any of the huge charges that Valley Dairy was having to pay. So they have huge, huge financial advantages that Valley Dairy unfortunately didn't enjoy.
Olson has filed an ethics complaint with the state against that action. Meanwhile, Kyle Buse is under federal indictment for misuse of the federal grant money that started the creamery. He has not been tried yet. Buse remains one of the three co-owners of the creamery, but has not been involved in its operations since 2008. McFarlane says the federal case against Buse has no bearing on the state's claim to creamery assets. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, mushers make their culinary choices for the upcoming Yukon Quest.
Let's see, some oatmeal cluster things. It's got a lot of good stuff in them, like white chocolate and all that kind of stuff.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
State rules for logging steep, unstable hillsides will see some language changes under a proposal from the Alaska Department of Natural Resources. The regulatory amendments were prompted by concerns from a group of Petersburg residents who worry that a potential timber sale will trigger landslides above their homes. They say the new wording fails to address the issue of public safety. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
The new language was recommended by the Alaska Board of Forestry, which advises on logging issues for state, municipal, and private lands. The Department of Natural Resources, Marty Freeman, is board liaison for the Division of Forestry.
We have a series of regulations that are designed to strengthen the current best management practices, which in Alaska are part of our regulations, that ensure that when forest operations occur, that they prevent or minimize significant adverse effects of soil erosion and mass wasting on fish habitat and water quality.
Mass wasting means landslides, and it was public concern over that danger in Petersburg that got the board talking about the issue. In 2005, the Alaska Mental Health Trust proposed a major timber sale for its land holdings along Mitkoff Highway. There was an outcry of opposition from a group of about 90 downslope residents who pointed out the steep hillside is prone to slides. Several have occurred over the years. Trust officials eventually agreed to try and swap that property for federal lands that could be logged elsewhere, but they left the Mitkoff harvest on the table if the swap didn't pan out with the Forest Service. So about 5 years ago, the homeowners approached the Board of Forestry in the hopes of getting some protections for their property under the Alaska Forest Practices Act. They asked for a regulation change to restrict or prevent logging on landslide-prone slopes if it posed a threat to public safety. According to Freeman, the board considered the issue over the course of 15 meetings and through two stakeholder committees.
The board decided that it was really primarily a local issue that would be most effectively addressed through local zoning authorities or, in the case of the Mitkoff Island issue, through an exchange between the Mental Health Trust and the U.S. Forest Service. And the board has sent a letter of support for that exchange. exchange proposal.
Well, none of the Division of Natural Resources proposed regulations pertain to public safety, which has been the focus of the Mitkoff Highway Homeowners Association.
Ed Wood is co-founder of that group, which still wants state forestry rules to include protections for human life and property.
Rather, the division's proposed changes represent the status quo and only pertain to fish streams and hillside runoff.
Wood points out that the Forest Practices Act already calls for the prevention of, quote, significant adverse effects of soil erosion and mass wasting on water quality and fish habitat, unquote. He says the board just tried to fine-tune those existing protections. By leaving public safety to local zoning rules, Wood says the board gave up the Division of Forestry's authority to regulate timber harvests.
This despite the fact that government at all levels, but especially the state, through its constitutional statement of policy, sold property and encouraged settlement in what turned out to be landslide hazard areas. It seems odd that DNR can opt out of its obligations to the people who bought land in good faith by not regulating logging on the steep, unstable slopes above their homes, while at the same time it updates its landslide standards for water quality and fish habitat.
In 2011, Wrangell Republican Representative Peggy Wilson introduced a bill to address public safety in the Forest Practices Act. The measure was heard by the House Resources Committee but never got a floor vote before the end of the session. The Division of Forestry's draft regulations are out for public review with a comment period that closes at the end of January. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
After refusing to implement an electronic monitoring program developed by fishermen, NOAA Fisheries is moving forward with a plan of its own to test cameras on boats this spring. But a top official who met with Sitka fishermen last week said too many questions remain about the system, and there's no way a functional electronic monitoring program could be ready in the next 2 years. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The monitoring of bottom fishing that takes place in federal waters off Alaska's coastline has come into the spotlight recently because hook and line and pot gear fishermen who operate relatively small boats from 40 to 57 and a half feet may be selected to carry human observers, basically a technician who counts and weighs some of the fish that come over the rail and takes tissue samples. Observers are, and have been for decades, an important tool for determining bycatch, the amount of fish caught unintentionally in the traditionally large boat fisheries. Martin Lefled, the director of NOAA's Observer Program in Seattle, told a room full of about 45 Sitka halibut and black cod fishermen that the goal was to assess everything that came out of the ocean. No one in the room disputed this goal, but getting there remains a problem, especially in a boat that may be no longer than a couple of large pickup trucks parked end to end. Lefled said he began his career in the late 1970s as an observer on the foreign fleet. He said electronic monitoring, cameras, were not going to replace human observers anytime soon.
I think the way to phrase it from my perspective is to develop it as a tool that can be used to some degree in the fisheries management process. I think it's unrealistic from my desk to think that it will ever take an otolith out of a fish. That's something we do.
An otolith is an ear bone used to determine the age of a species. But Lefled conceded that electronic monitoring one day could be very useful in determining the location and time of fishing, the number of fish, and the composition of the catch, and possibly its weight.
An awful lot of what we do is managed by weight and not by number of fish. So the weight is kind of a key consideration.
Speaking from the audience, Linda Benkin, the director of the Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association, noted that 90% of the catch was landed at onshore processors where this data could be easily collected. Lefled suggested that was inadequate.
If there are some beasts that simply never make it to the dock, the only way to get those beasts is on the boat.
He went on to say that there was potential for cameras to have a primary role with human observers in a secondary role supplementing that information. Lefled said NOAA planned to spend about $200,000 testing electronic monitoring on volunteer boats this season. Besides scientific data, he said there are other details to consider. Who's obligated to power the system? Who's responsible for keeping it clean and functioning? And could a fishing trip be cut short if the electronic monitoring system failed? Lefled said his office planned to get a draft document before the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council by this June, but even if some of these basic questions could be addressed, he could pretty much guarantee you won't have regs in place by 2014. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the 2013 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
Jeff King of Denali won the Kuskokwim 300 sled dog race for the ninth time yesterday. 21 teams competed. From Member Station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
Give it up for Jeff King. Ladies and gentlemen, here comes your 2013 Kuskokwim 300 champion.
The field was competitive, but 56-year-old Jeff King proved that he still knows how to win this race better than anyone else. The veteran musher crossed the finish line at 11 a.m., an hour before the rest of the field. King says he tries to balance the right speed for the right distance, which can be a challenge when the dog's natural instinct is to go faster than he wants.
You need to take a look at my brake on the back of my sled. It is just trashed. I haven't had a brake for 150 miles because it just disintegrated with the full strength of my weight and the sled, and on this ice it just exploded.
He started the race with the dog in his sled bag, and he had others using just their necklines so they wouldn't pull too hard. It paid off with a $22,000 first place prize. King finished in front of second place Tony Browning of Nenana and third place Pete Kaiser of Bethel, among a slew of other Iditarod veterans. Browning, who runs dogs for Aaron Burmeister's kennel, said he expected to win, but his dogs got sick in the middle of the race.
Had to nurse them all the way around Whitefish Lake. Spent a couple of hours here, a couple of hours there.
The 55-year-old says when his dog started feeling better, he was able to pass all the other teams but King's. For second place, Browning takes home $16,500, which he says will go to orphans in Kenya, Africa, part of his missionary work he does when he's not mushing. This race was the 34th running of the K300, which is known for its adverse conditions. Racers left Bethel Friday night on an icy trail, facing a 35 below zero headwind. Saturday, they traveled through blowing snow, and on the final stretch, it was above freezing. For mushers like Browning, that's just what they were after.
Really, we just came over to put some good hard miles on them, because this is the place to do it. I mean, you get all the weather, you get everything.
Finishing fourth was Paul Gephardt, fifth was Sim Smith, and sixth, Roan Boozer. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Mushers in Fairbanks and Whitehorse handed over thousands of pounds of dog food, human food, and personal items to Yukon Quest race officials last Saturday. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, the annual food drop brings both a sense of relief and a taste of reality to those who are signed up to run in the International Sled Dog Race.
Yukon Quest volunteer Casey Van Dor walks in circles around and around a wooden pallet piled high with bulky white nylon bags. He's wrapping the piles in thick, clear plastic and labeling them with Yukon Quest checkpoint names. This is Van Dor's first year as a race volunteer.
So I like watching the race. It's nice to chip in and help.
He's among roughly 25 volunteers who are helping unload, stack, wrap, and move thousands of pounds of drop bags for this year's race. Alex Olison is the race manager.
Every bag is limited at 40 pounds, and if they're all in that right around 40-pound range, then the math just adds on up.
In Fairbanks, it adds up to more than 5,000 pounds of dog food, human food, dog booties, dry socks, and other gear that Olison will expedite to 9 checkpoints along the race course this week.
It's like the first move in a Rube Goldberg machine of moving all these things out to all these places.
When he arrived in South Fairbanks to drop off his bags, rookie musher Cody Straith still had some packing to do.
I needed some more batteries.
But I did get some Werther's Originals and some Ricola. Keep me going down the trail.
Straith tosses the last minute items into his bags and fastens them closed with zip ties. But he's not the only musher who still had a few things to sort out.
I had to run over to Freddy's and get some socks and some 5-hour energy drinks. Musher priorities.
2012 champion Hugh Neff of Toke unloads more than 30 bags from his blue pickup truck. He decided to make the best of the trip to Fairbanks over the weekend.
We're actually going to go up and do a training run on Eagle Summit, so I'm looking forward to that. Get some of these younger dogs used to the trail.
This will be Neff's 13th go at the 1,000-mile race. Of the 26 teams signed up, 15 are veterans, and last year's top five finishers are all returning.
Oh, I think it's the best Quest field ever, and we say this often, but I really believe it this time.
Neff's competition includes 2012 second-place finisher Alan Moore, who says he'll only change a few things for his third run of the Quest.
Let's see. Try to make up 26 seconds, maybe. But
that's the amount of time that stood between Moore and Neff last year, and it's not all that Moore has lost during the race.
2 years ago, I lost 25 pounds.
You did?
I did in the race. Last year, I didn't lose that much, but it wasn't that cold last year, so I only lost 10, 15. Yeah.
That's why he has some extra treats in his drop bags.
Let's see. There's some oatmeal cluster things. It's got a lot of good stuff in them, like white chocolate and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, those are the first things I'm going for.
Musher Brent Sass is known for gourmet trail food, and as usual, his bags are filled with tasty morsels.
Candied bacon's back, of course.
Sass is running the Quest for the 7th time. He watches as volunteers sort his bags by checkpoint.
I still feel like a rookie, though, when I'm packing them. So I've gotten a bunch of calls. Oh, we want to get the veteran's point of view, and I'm still not feeling like a veteran in this race.
One thing he has learned over the years is how to speed through checkpoints. That's why his drop bags are painted black and gold. A few other mushers have also painted their otherwise nondescript bags with different colors. It makes them easy to spot among the hundreds of others at each checkpoint. With food drops complete, mushers only have mandatory vet checks left before they all head to Whitehorse for the 30th running of the Yukon Quest International Sled Dog Race. I'm Emily Schwing in Fairbanks.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Tim Ellis in Delta, Ellen Lockyer in Palmer, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Angela Denning-Barnes in Bethel, and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
And by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, supporting the Clare House Replacement Project. There's more information online at cssalaska.org. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give, or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
The Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority was created by the Alaska State Legislature to develop, stimulate, and advance the economic welfare of the state and further the development of public transportation systems. The authority has completed required environmental work to date, and the Federal Highway Administration has given its approval needed to move forward. There's more information at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.